This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, Jim Carrey and Margaret Atwood are just like our local MPs when it comes to getting snubbed by Russia. We'll hear how you can help Loaves and Fishes in their mission to make sure everyone has a Merry Christmas. A former Cape Breton Oiler fan favorite is dropping the gloves these days for the Boston Bruins. And a Cape Breton comedian says not only do we have some of the best musicians in the business, but we also punch above our weight with so many funny people on the island. That's up first with Clifton Cremo.
It started out very young, but it wasn't really an active interest. You know, it was just something that I watched in my spare time. My parents, my uncle watched a lot of comedy. A big comedic influence for me is Weird Al Yankovic. I specifically remember that my uncle got me Weird Al's CD Running with Scissors in 1999. He came home from Newfoundland and he gave me Weird Al's CD. And I just fell in love with it, and I've been a big fan of Weird Al ever since. My mom watched a lot of stand-up comedy growing up, and so I was around it a lot, and I was a big fan. But like actively pursuing it was never really an interest of mine.
Someone in your family, Clifton, people may recognize your last name, especially fiddle music fans, but someone in your family was a very famous Cape Breton fiddler.
Yeah, my grandfather was Lee Cremo, like you said, a very famous fiddler. He did a lot of things, and he wasn't there for much of my life. He passed away when I was 7 years old, but he was a very big influence. Those formative years are very important, you know. That's a big time in a person's life when you're learning everything. So when you're around someone like that, You really learn to appreciate art and comedy. Like he was known for being funny. Everyone I meet who finds out, like, who is familiar with my grandfather, is always like, "Oh, you're Lee's grandson? Oh my God!" And then they'll go on to tell me a story about how he was like, he made them laugh. It's never about how he blew them away with a performance. It's always about how funny or personable he was. I didn't get to see many of his performances. He played the fiddle so much at home, so I would hear him play there. But I had never really gone to any of his shows or anything. So all my familiarity with my grandfather is at home, conversing, stuff like that. Anything that I do with like the Mi'kmaq language is it came from him. That's where I learned it from. It wasn't spoken majorly by anyone else in the household except for him. So, yeah.
Do you remember the last time we talked? We were actually still out in Glace Bay at the time, but it was over the telephone. You talked about how your grandfather could do things in a spontaneous way. He could do his craft without preparing much. And I have to say that kind of happened here with us today, too. Our studios now are at the Eldwig Arts Center in downtown Sydney, and I saw you in the hallway, and we were getting the show together, and I thought, geez, it'd be great to get Clifton on the show again, and here you are just a couple of seconds later with a microphone, no time to prepare doing an interview, but as a stand-up comedian, you must be very used to doing things, thinking on your feet quickly without preparing much.
I guess so. Yeah, I'm not going to turn down, you know, if someone asks me to do something, right, and I'm able to do it, I'll do it. This I don't find having a conversation particularly hard. So now that I'm trying to say that it's not hard, it's kind of getting harder. but yeah, you asked me in the hallway, and I wasn't particularly busy, so why not?
Well, yeah, actually, you were with some NSCC students for the music campus that's actually just down the hall here. Are you working on a project with them?
Oh, no. So I'm on the board of directors for Lumiere Arts Festival this year. And this year, normally it is an outdoor festival taking place downtown Sydney, but it was postponed due to Hurricane Fiona. And now that it's so late in the year with weather and all that, we had to move it indoors, so we're having it here at the Eldwig Arts Center.
Oh, yes, Clifton, no question there. You always seem very willing to offer a helping hand. I notice a lot of your activity on Facebook. You're very good at engaging your friends and networking and promoting your shows. And I noticed that you've actually worked recently with some very well-known names in the comedy community here in Cape Breton. Can you talk about that, please?
Most recently, I did a fundraiser for Hurricane Fiona that was held at the Savoy Theater in Glace Bay. I got to work with Ron James for the first time. Ron is originally from Glace Bay, and he wanted to he approached the organizers. He wanted to raise some money for his home community, and they threw together the show. So when they contacted me, they were like, "We're putting on a show with some of Cape Breton's best talent." I was incredibly honored, you know, to have been considered even. So I said yes, and got to work with him and Maynard Morrison and Bette McDonald, they were the comedians, and then there were the Island Girls and the Bear McNeils and Jimmy Rankin were all on stage.
Bette McDonald, Maynard Morrison, Ron James, just about everyone's heard of them. And I think a lot of people would agree, too, that people from Cape Breton are, so many of them are very funny. Some of the funniest people you will ever meet live here. But, you know, they're carpenters, they're nurses, they're teachers, they're just the average Joe. Is that something that you would agree to, that there's something about Cape Breton that there's some extremely, extremely funny people here?
Cape Bretoners are so funny. Like, we're known, I guess, for music and fiddle and stuff like that, but, like, not really the gift of gab that we've got.
Yeah, right.
Or like, there's so many similarities to Newfoundland, and people always talk about how funny Newfoundlanders are.
Sure.
But they don't necessarily talk about how funny Cape Bretoners are, and I think that's a big missed opportunity. Something that I would really like to do is get, like, a comedy festival or something going on in Cape Breton, because, like, yeah, I'd really like to see a Cape Breton comedy festival, because we have so many great festivals that happen in Cape Breton, and even more, we're seeing more and more now, so much more investment into the arts community here in Cape Breton. Like, we have the Making Waves Festival, music festival that happens in downtown Sydney. They have the Inverness Sunset Series that happens in Inverness. More music. There's the Celtic Colors Festival. There's, as I mentioned earlier, Lumiere Arts Festival that happens in the fall, typically right before Celtic Colors starts. But there's no comedy. There's no comedy, and it's not like it's not like comedy is a foreign thing. Like you said, it's very local. Like the people are funny here, and you see it a lot with, like, not maybe not Celtic Colors shows, but a lot of the musicians here will put together, like, you know, the Maritime Review or whatever, where there are comedy skits in between musical acts and stuff like that. So there is a culture for comedy, and it's even built into the musical scene. So I'd like to see that branch out more.
Great idea there, Clifton. Let's pick it up there next time we chat. Before we go, though, anyone interested in seeing your shows or learning more about your material, what do you have coming up on your schedule?
All right. What do I have coming up? So next week, on the 18th and 19th of November, I'm going to be in Mill River PEI, performing on a show at the Mill River Resort with Sean Hogan and Leonard Chan. Sean Hogan is producing the show and hosting. He's a very good friend of mine from PEI. Leonard Chan is from Ontario. I've worked with him at the Halifax Comedy Festival for the last couple of years. Both incredible comics. That's going to be a very fun show. Unfortunately, I do believe both shows are sold out now. So that's great. On the 22nd of November, Tuesday the 22nd, I'm going to be in Halifax at the Carlton, opening for my friend Matt Baker, who is recording his comedy album at, I believe, 7 and 9 or 7:30 and 9:30. Two shows at the Carlton in Halifax on the 22nd. And on December 1st, this isn't a comedy show, but on December 1st in Eskazoni, my hometown of Eskazoni, I'm organizing a film screening of Night Raiders, which is a film by Indigenous filmmaker Danis Goulet. That was released last year to positive reviews, and very good film. And I think it's just a really great event to be showing an Indigenous-made film in Escazoni, open to the public. It's free. All like tickets are free. Just gotta reserve your spot and show up, and it should be a great night on December 1st at 7 o'clock at the Sarah Denny Cultural Center.
It's 41 years this year that Loaves and Fishes started back in 1981. And the manager of Loaves and Fishes is Marco Amati's with me here in the program. Welcome once again.
Good morning.
1981, a group of concerned citizens thought it would be a temporary way to feed people. But here we are 41 years later, and the need is so, so great and keeps on getting bigger and bigger each and every year. And now that the weather is colder and getting closer and closer to Christmas, we want everybody to have a Merry Christmas. It's just going to get busy from here on in.
Yes, you're right, Bill. It is getting colder, and this year with the power bills and the food prices and all that sort of stuff, people can't manage it. But at least we're here to at least give them a meal a day. And, you know, we look at it, nobody goes hungry during the cold months. It's going to be a tough road.
Typically, the numbers go up as we get colder temperatures and into the around the Christmas time, even after Christmas. It wouldn't be uncommon to get numbers between 165 to 185, right?
Right. That's what we're hitting now. And that's since the storm that we had, the hurricane, and since the pandemic, really. So 3 years has been steadily going up. We were averaging 130. Now we're up above 180.
Now, if folks want to donate, I know there's many ways they can do so. If you were to come up with a wish list of things that you need right now and over the next couple of weeks to feed people coming into the Christmas season, what would it be?
Well, one thing important that we have right now, we give packages out to all the patrons, so we're really looking for toiletry stuff, also mitts, hats, scarves, wool socks, you know, thermal underwears, that kind of stuff that we're looking for packages.
A lot of people have been hit hard. You mentioned about Fiona, but this is not for everybody. If you can help out, it could be as simple as buying a $10 gift card or make a donation. There's different ways you can do that. Run through the list of ways if folks want to donate.
Yes, you can go on our website. It's loavesandfishescb.com. That's one way to donate. Also, another way is e-transfers to our email, which is loavesandfishes139@yahoo.ca, or you can come in or send it in the mail, either way. Also, gift cards are really good because that'll give us a chance to go out and buy what we need. And during the winter months, with food prices going up, I do a lot of shopping, like going through the flyers. So wherever I can get a bargain, that's where I go.
As we mentioned before, the numbers keep going up, and I'm sure you're seeing new faces, you know, groceries or paying for oil or your electric heat and then your rent. There's certain things that you have to cut out, and unfortunately, some of those things on the list is food. So this would be a great way to give back and make somebody's Christmas even merrier. And, you know, we've talked many times before, and it's not just a slogan, but you feel good knowing that you're helping somebody else out, and they feel good knowing that they're getting a great meal.
You are right. And it's a real good meal. So it's a big meal that they get here. So like we said, we try to get their belly full before they leave here because nobody should be hungry. You need food to nourish your mind, right? So that's what we're here for. And we're here 7 days a week. So somebody could eat here 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And you're right, with the bills that are piling up, it's just getting, oh, the economy is just, it's tough out there. It's not just tough for them, it's tough for me, tough for everybody.
Now, on a personal note, I'm sure you have people come over and talk to you and say, thank you for this because I didn't know where to turn. And people have it tough.
Oh, they do. You know, they're thanking us every day for being here, and they know with a hot meal and then a roof over their head just to get out of the cold for a bit, or, you know, so get in the heat. So that's one thing we give here, a nice, safe environment. So they're thanking us every day, and, you know, if it makes us feel good that we can do that for them.
So once again, for folks that maybe tuned in late, tell us how they can donate and what can they donate.
Well, they can donate money or gift cards. And also for Christmas time, we're looking for toiletry items such as shampoo, deodorant, that kind of stuff, toothpaste, and also mitts, hats, gloves. We put a package together for them, and we try to keep them warm for the winter.
Appreciate this, and hopefully we get some more help and to help out individuals in our community. Appreciate it once again.
You're right. Thanks, Bill.
Dennis Bonvia had a stellar career as a professional hockey player. When he was with the Cape Breton Oilers in Sydney, he never disappointed. You'll hear Dennis talk about an event on the ice that put him in the AHL Hall of Fame, and he'll talk about one of his favorite hockey movies.
I asked my dad when I was five if I could play, go to Prodoxbury and play. That's the district I was in, and he took me and my mom and dad, were great. They were so supportive my whole life on what I did and the decisions I make to try to pursue my hockey dreams. Did I take my now playing midget, playing, you just keep striving to get a little better and do a little better. You don't know where it's going to take you. I'm sure every kid has that dream of playing in the National Hockey League. I certainly hope they do, but I'm not saying that's, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but every kid's got a dream and aspire to be better and want to do more. There's no doubt about that.
And just looking at your resume here, quite impressive. Played many years in the OHL, the AHL, the NHL, of course, the Cape Breton Oilers as well. So, 93-94, your first year for the Cape Breton Oilers. What can you tell us about your time here in Sydney when you laced up for the Oilers?
Well, I was pretty fortunate. I was in North Bay, Ontario in junior. I got drafted to Kitchener, and then I got traded to North Bay the next year. And I played two wonderful years in the OHL. Then I got a tryout to the Calgary Flames, went there for 2 weeks, got released, and then I guess probably a week later, I got a tryout thanks to Glenn Sather and Dave Andrews and George Burnett. They give me a tryout to the Cape Breton Oilers, and I did okay. I don't think they had any plans on keeping me there per se. It was, but I did all right. I guess I opened a couple eyes, and first thing I ended up getting a contract, which was pretty nice. To stay in the American Hockey League.
And you played a specialty role, what we call an enforcer, in the interesting documentary, by the way, on Netflix called The Guardians of the Ice. But you developed this specialty, a very special position on the ice. How did that develop, and when did you know that you could play this role very well?
Well, you always hope you can, and I do it to gain respect amongst my peers and amongst my, guys on the other team and the best, toughest guys in the league. You always aspire to do a little, to prove that I belonged. And I just kept doing that, and I did well. I always say it, if I hadn't done well the first two or three times, I probably would have stopped doing it, right? But I did okay, and just keep forging ahead.
Is this something that you defend, Dennis? Is this a very important part of the game?
Yeah, well, it certainly was. There's no doubt about it. It was a part of the game, and I went, and at that point it was legal to do that and represent your team, and I did it to the best of my ability. Obviously, the rules have changed and evolved since then. It's not as prevalent, I guess the word is, or not as, you don't see it very often anymore, and that's just the way the game is going. But, I still think there was some high-level compete in the game where, you got physicality and stuff happened off of that. So, it's just not as much fighting anymore, but, they express, I think the more skating and skill level is at a higher, certainly at a higher level than it was, in years past. But, that was just the type of game we played that I played and that was part of it. And, like I said, it's since evolved into less of that and a little more speed and skill.
Dennis, I have to give a shout out to one of my good buddies, Kevin Beaton. He was excited that I was going to get to talk to you for the radio station. He wanted me to ask you a question. Suppose your stick went to the Hall of Fame because you scored the first ever AHL All-Star Game goal. Is that correct?
Yeah, I ended up, it was a second-year pro. I think second-year pro. in Cape Breton, and I think that was the lockout year. Yeah, I guess it was 94. And it was a voting type thing. And I think Todd Marchand was the highest voter. But when the voting ended and the leagues and the All-Star game in between there, the lockout ended. So Todd got called up. I was the next guy in line in terms of votes from our team. So I got put in the All-Star game. So I was eligible for the All-Star game. And ended up Ralph Entrenouvel came with me. And what happened is, we caught them on a line change. The guy passed it wide. I went in on Scott Bailey, a goalie. I think he was at Providence Bruins at the time, but he was in the All-Star game. And put a quick move on and put in the, you know, put a five-hole on him. But pretty fortunate that happened. And they come over to the bench and say, we're going to take your stick and gloves. And I joked. I said, I'm hot. You can't have them. He said, well, they're going to the Hockey Hall of Fame. And I said, yeah, you can have whatever you need to take it. One of those. So it's a pretty neat experience for sure.
That's a different way to lose your gloves in the game instead of dropping them on the ice. That's pretty neat.
Yeah, exactly.
Good stuff. Now, of course, there's a second act to your career, and congratulations, by the way, promoted to Director of Pro Scouting. All the Bruins fans out there will like to hear this with your Cape Breton connection. You're the new Director of Pro Scouting for the Boston Bruins. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I've been fortunate. When I finished in 08, I went right into pro scouting with the Boston Bruins. With the Toronto Maple Leafs, I got an opportunity. Cliff Fletcher was a GM there, and Al Coach was saying, Mike Penny was my boss for scouting. And they knew me from the prior, so they gave me an opportunity. Then a year later, I went on with Chicago Blackhawks, Stan Bowen, and Mark Bergevin gave me an opportunity. I was 6 years there. And then I ended up switching over to Boston when Donnie Sweeney got the job. I had played with Don in Boston for my year stint there. And, we stayed in contact, and he was fortunate enough himself, and Cam Neely himself, gave me an opportunity to come to another wonderful organization. Toronto was great. Chicago was great, obviously, original six teams, and I got in with Boston. It's been really, really good. And I slowly just, I'd like to say put in my dues, but I should try to see a lot of hockey and find players to make our organization better. And I think a lot of people will say the same thing that are scouting. They do the same thing. And you just look for an opportunity. And fortunate enough, Cam and Don, our management ownership, give me an opportunity to move on up a little bit.
So as far as pro scouting going, what can you tell us about that job? That's, you obviously have a very good understanding of what's happening on the ice. You need an understanding of what's happening in the head office. And how do you know talent when you see it?
Well, you're not going to go say that I see talent better than everybody else. You see talent the same as, everybody else for the most part. You try to see the best in a player. That's what you try to do. When you try to put him into your situation, into the Boston Bruins organization. And sometimes you take a bit of a risk, but I think they're calculated risks where you do your research and you watch the player and you see him in good games, you see him in bad, and then you assess the opportunity, I guess is the easy way. But we do that as a group, We do that as a group, and Don Sweeney and Cam, they do a good job of having us all involved, and then everybody says their opinion, and then we go from there, type of thing. So it's a group. It's certainly a group effort.
That's really interesting. The Boston Bruins with the Atlantic Canadian connection there. Don Sweeney's from New Brunswick.
Yeah, certainly is. Yeah, he's from St. Stephen, Callis, right there.
How did you and Don hit it off? Did it kind of give you just that immediate establishment and bond to work together?
He got the job, and I was one of his first guys. He came and wanted me to come help, work for the Boston Bruins, which was an honor and a privilege. And you just go in and you try to continue to gain the person's respect, and then show everybody, especially him, that you know what you're doing and what you're seeing, and you're promoting the right players, not the wrong ones, because you can't promote the wrong ones too long. You won't have a job, type of thing. So that's just the business you're in. So that's what you try to do, and that's in any business. You try to continue to gain traction and gain, certainly support from the upper level and people you have to answer to for your bosses. And that's all I try to do. Gain some trust,
Now, I heard this. I'm not sure if this is a rumor. I certainly hope it's true. But talking about another Nova Scotia connection, Andy Gnish, in fact, but a very funny and famous movie called Slapshot. Paul Newman's role was actually based on John Brophy of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Is that right?
I think so. I believe so. Yes. it's just such an old school, funny, you know what, off the cuff type show that you can continue to watch, and every time you watch it, you find out something funny again and again and again, something different. So it's you know, how many times can you continue to watch Slapshot and still find it funny and find out some new stuff type of thing, you know, which is great. It's iconic.
Yeah, I wish I could play a clip from it, but there would be a lot of beeps in there.
Right?
I see we're running out of time here. Dennis, I had a lot more things I'd like to talk to you about, but what would you like to say as well about your new career path here scout for the Bruins?
You know what? I've been fortunate enough to get my opportunity to start in the Edmonton organization, but, you know, in Cape Breton, which is a couple hours from my home in Frankville, you know, Nova Scotia. So, fortunate enough, my parents come to see me quite a bit when I was down there, you know, I got started, and, you know, that's where my roots were. And, you know, the people there were wonderful. They made me feel so comfortable. And, you know, and then I continued to just kind of take baby steps from there and continue to move forward, which is what I wanted to do. And I got opportunities that people, you know, keep, you know, giving me opportunities to continue to move forward and trudge ahead. So I just try to do it to the best of my ability, continue to get better every day. And, you know, I think you can say that for everybody. You know, you try to, you know, I loved what I did, but I worked hard at what I did, and I try to just continue to move ahead in what I did, and things have slowly worked out, there's no doubt. So thank you to Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, and just the hockey community itself.
Okay, take care.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, Jim Carr again. Dennis, I know that some in our audience don't know the finer points of hockey. Could you tell them, for example, what is icing?
Well, icing happen when the puck come down, bang, you know, before the other guys, mm-hmm. nobody there, you know. Mm-hmm. My arm comes out, then the game stop, then start up.
Mm-hmm. I see. What is high sticking?
High sticking happen when the guy take the stick, you know, and he go like that. You know, you don't do that.
You don't do that?
Oh, no, never, never.
Why not?
Against the rules. You know, you're stupid when you do that.
What is slashing?
Slashing is like that, you know.
Mm-hmm. And there's a penalty for that?
Yeah. And for a trip also, you know, like that. And mm-hmm. for hook, like this. And for spear, you know, like that. Mm-hmm. All bad.
Bad.
You do that, you go to the box, you know, 2 minutes by yourself, and you feel shame, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get free.
The Chiefs are at home tonight against Cyanisport at the War Memorial at 8. Good seats are still available.
Xavier Thériault took the road trip of a lifetime. The 23-year-old left Halifax and ended up in the far north about 100 days later. But this was no ordinary road trip. There was no set schedule, a lot of ups and downs, and every day became an unexpected adventure behind the wheel of a 53-year-old car. And even though it was his first cross-country trip, it was kind of like a trip down memory lane.
Yeah, so basically, yeah, when I was very young, my dad owned an old Volkswagen Westfalia, and we always went on trips and stuff. And I think that kind of instilled in me that the idea that like old cars and old vans kind of like give you good memories. And I think when the pandemic hit, I had this old car already, the old Volvo in my possession, and I just really wanted to travel, but I couldn't because of current travel restrictions that I can only do through Canada. And I don't know, I guess I put two ideas together and decided to go on this crazy adventure throughout Canada. So my idea was to initially hit the Atlantic Ocean to the Arctic Ocean. Yeah, it's a long distance to traverse. I think it's In 98 days, you don't really, it's spread out so thin, the kilometers per day, that you don't really think about it, but it's a lot on a car, like 16,600 kilometers. It's also a lot on a person, you know. It makes you realize the absolute scale of Canada, the different biomes you drive through. But as I was actually driving through Saskatchewan, I figured I'll do the Pacific Ocean as well. So I ended up doing all three in about 98 days and 16,600 kilometers.
Can you talk about the car that you drove across the country? You don't see many of those, a Volvo, and it's more than 50 years old.
Yes. So the car is a bit of an unusual choice. It's a 1969 Volvo 144. And I'm sure a lot of people will say, you know, that is a terrible idea. And it is a terrible idea. But I guess I wanted something that would bring me a certain level of I was taking a chance, you know. I wanted something that I could, if it was going to be break down, at least I could fix it myself, but also something that I would just feel a connection with while driving on the road, because it's such a quirky car, you know. Like, it has, you know, when you go uphill, you can't go a certain speed, or I don't know, it looks different. It just, I just wanted something that was different for the trip.
And you sure knew what you were getting into. I think you had mentioned that the car had broken down even before the trip started during the test drive. So did you have any trouble along the way?
Oh, yes, plenty. I would say the biggest, the one that almost ended the trip, was actually in Ontario, Thunder Bay. The drive shaft let go, which I guess in any normal car wouldn't be a big issue, but for mine, they don't sell that part anymore. And obviously, I'm in a different province, had no connections, absolutely no connections, and the car is quite rare as it is. So I was actually planning on maybe renting a hotel while I was there for a few days and kind of think about maybe how I was going to sell the car. I don't know, because I didn't want to lose hope, but I was also being realistic. But I ended up going on Facebook groups and just posting an ad, you know, here's a picture of me, what I'm doing, and what I was looking for, a drive shaft. And I waited for a few hours, and I was kind of getting worried. But then my actually Facebook post got a lot of traction in the groups, and I ended up getting a phone call from a man called Kenneth, and he was five blocks away from me and had the drive shaft. It was an incredible feeling. He ended up just picking me up. We went down to his little field he had. It was a rusted old bucket sitting in the grass. We ended up lifting it up, taking off the drive shaft, and you know what? It was a perfect fit. And so basically within, I don't know, a handful of hours, I was back on the road, all good to go, new drive shaft.
So going from coast to coast and driving through most of the provinces and the Northwest Territories and the Yukon, it must have given you an interesting vantage point seeing Canada up close and personal like that. Do you feel like you have a different appreciation for the different cultures and the social landscape that we have in Canada?
Yes. So before the trip, I'd never left Canada. And I think that, I don't know, I guess clouded my judgment on what Canada was for me anyways. Because like the East Coast is so different from the West Coast or the middle part of Canada. But what I learned is that, like, even though we're separated by a huge amount of kilometers, like, we're all kind of the same in a way. Like, we all kind of hold the same values, even though we might have different political opinions or we might have just a different outlook on other parts of Canada. Like, we're all super, super nice, super giving and just kind. Everyone is so kind, no matter where you go in Canada.
You know, people who live in northern Canada or they get a chance to visit there, they get an up-close view of Aurora Borealis, especially this time of year. So what was it like for you seeing the northern lights in that area, north of the Arctic Circle?
That was an incredible moment. When I went, actually, initially, it was very cloudy because the cold front and the warm front of the ocean would meet together and create clouds. So when I was really up in the north, it was cloudy every day. You know, I didn't really have a chance to see the Aurora Borealis. But actually, under the clouds, sometimes I would see like a green hue, you know, at night. And I was so excited, but I couldn't really see it because of the clouds. But I remember one day distinctly, I was in the Yukon fixing up my car, and I stayed the night over in like a little walking trail in the woods with some friends I met from Germany. And the clouds cleared, and we had this amazing show of Northern Lights. It was incredible. Yeah, it's an incredible feeling seeing them in real life.
And after a 16,000-kilometer journey, what did you do when you finally arrived in Toktoyaktuk?
So, when I arrived, obviously, I went straight to the Arctic Ocean sign, took a picture, had my little karai, and then I was just like, I guess I'm going to figure it out. And I called around. There was actually two commercial kind of Airbnb situations. I wouldn't say hotel, but it was basically like rent a room in my house kind of thing. So I ended up renting a room in a house for one night. Had this amazing shower, which was well needed. Just kind of cooled down, called my parents, called my friends, and kind of celebrated. The next day, though, I ended up just walking around, and it's a very small village. Like, it's all dirt roads and quite small, but very, very scenic. So I ended up talking to some locals again, and then made friends with someone, and he ended up actually inviting me for Thanksgiving supper with his parents. So we all spent Thanksgiving supper together, which was incredibly nice of them. I had like turkey and a home cooked meal, which was the first in months. And they ended up giving me a bed in a like fishing cabin by the ocean for the night, which was also incredible.
And Xavier, in just a minute, we're going to tell people where they can go online to learn more about your travels that you documented very well, by the way. But is there a story or two that you might be able to share with us now? I'm sure there are plenty of them, but is there anything you'd like to talk about right now?
I have a story from like on top of a mountain. I basically almost froze to death with somebody I met like 24 hours prior, but I'm trying to find something that's not too hardcore, you know?
Well, if you're comfortable talking about that, go right ahead. It's obviously, it had a happy ending. You're still here.
Yeah. No, it for sure it does. Okay, yeah, sure. So when I arrived in Jasper initially, I took the northern route, yeah, to Jasper, to the mountains. So it was my first time seeing mountains in my entire life, the Rocky Mountains. And I was, you know, enamored. Like, I was in love with the mountains. And it was incredible. Like, it just seemed bigger than life itself. So when I arrived, I pulled over at some little pullover in the National Park of Jasper and took some pictures. And I actually noticed another car next to me full of, like, you know, camping stuff and a pillow and stuff. So I was like, oh, I think he's sleeping in his car. So I went to talk to him. He ended up sharing stories, and he was sleeping in his car. He was actually from Saskatchewan. So he had a campground rented out. So he decided to go for the night in the campground. And I just stayed there at the pullout to sleep. But we decided to meet up the next day. So we met up the next day for sunrise, took some more pictures. And then we looked at each other and said, you know what? You know what would be cool? Camping on top of that mountain there. We just pointed at a random mountain. And ended up having a tent. So we basically just spent the day hiking up this massive mountain in shorts. I had shorts and a flannel. And he had, I think, shorts and a t-shirt. And he had a sleeping bag. I didn't. But we had a tent. So that was the idea. But the thing is, I guess I didn't really know, like, better. I didn't know that, like, the weather would be so different up there. You know, I figured it'd be a little colder, but it was, like, 10, 15 degrees colder. So once we ended up going to at the top, it started raining, but it was like 3 degrees Celsius. And I was in a flannel and shorts. He was in, you know, he was in a t-shirt and shorts as well. So we set up the tent, night started to fall, and we were on the peak of this mountain. It was so windy. Nobody knew we were up there. There was no signal, no nothing. And it ended up going to -5. So we went through a snowstorm as well. And in the middle of the night, I remember he was in his sleeping bag, which was made for like summer camping, he was shivering. I was like frozen. I was shivering too, but I was so scared. And we also got, I think in the middle of the night, we heard like gravel footsteps around the tent and like heavy breathing. And 5 minutes later, we opened the tent, looked outside, and we saw a black mass moving away. So we heard later there was like black bears around that mountain. So we basically didn't sleep at all, and we couldn't move our fingers to close the tent. So we basically had to use our nub to close the tent and then like zip it up and basically hike back down. It was quite the adventure. And honestly, I'm not like, if it had been 2 degrees colder, like we probably would have lost limbs or like, you know, froze to death. Like, no joke. It was very scary.
Oh, well, glad you made it back down. It must have been nice to get back down to civilization after a harrowing experience like that.
Oh, it was. Yeah, it was.
And you kept your spirits up. You didn't feel discouraged to continue on after that.
No. I was like, that was awesome. Let's do it again, but like better prepared, you know. I feel like every time something happened, like something crazy happened, I always saw the reason why and like how I could do it again without going through that problem, you know. So, no, I wasn't discouraged.
Geez, what an incredible journey. You really tested yourself there, Xavier.
Yeah, for sure. It's, you got to go out of your comfort zone once in a while. And, I would probably just recommend educating yourself first. That was like, I should have known better, but, you know.
Okay, so on that note, Xavier, where can people find the photos and the notes from your journey for anyone who's interested in learning more?
So they can actually find my Instagram. It's XavierTheriot98. And basically documented the whole thing on film. And I also retold the stories on just in the caption. I just retold the story. And yeah, you can find everything there.
Russia has added 100 more Canadian names to its list of people banned from entering the country, and that includes actor Jim Carrey and author Margaret Atwood. Both of our Cape Breton Liberal members of Parliament are already on that list, and we spoke to them earlier this year about this. We're going to hear from them again. Here's Sydney Victoria MP Jaime Batiste, and then we're going to hear Bobby Knock have a conversation with Cape Breton Kanso MP Mike Kellaway.
Actually, we're all sanctioned, every member of Parliament. All 338 of us who attended the Zelensky speech were sanctioned. I'm number 18 on the list, and so I kind of wear that as a badge of honor. Truthfully, you know, I'm going to be there to listen to the truth and not turn away from things when our prime minister asks us to listen to leaders from other countries. We will do that, even if it means personal sanctions against us. And so, these are things that come with being a member of Parliament in one of the NATO countries. But, we're all trying to do is find ways to get to peace at the end of the day and not escalate things further. So, you know, it's always my first and foremost concern to find avenues for peace, but also to, you know, support our friends and allies. But we are hoping that the amount of sanctions and the amount of unity in NATO right now with our sanctions to suffocate the Russian economy is going to have its toll on Russia. They never expected to be into this war a month. They didn't expect NATO's to join and do sanctions against them as to the point of uniting NATO in a position to say, you know, we're going to do everything our possible to deter any further invasions and to show strength.
Cape Breton Kanso MP Mike Kellaway.
Well, it was interesting. Shortly after leaving the chamber after President Zelensky's speech, I was notified actually by staff back here in Cape Breton that there was a site from ultimately from the Kremlin that highlighted a number of MPs that were banned on the I guess it's the blacklist, as they call it, and I was number 123. And so, and then, of course, I've heard from the Prime Minister's staff that I was on the list as well. That all happened probably within 20 minutes after the speech by Zelensky and the Prime Minister and opposition leaders in the chamber, which was quite moving. But I take it as a certainly a badge of honor. I stand with, as we all do, the people of Ukraine. We have a Ukraine population here in Cape Breton. I've have had some chats with Father Roman with the Ukraine Church, but it's really the individuals in the Ukraine that are standing up, a man, woman, child, and the least we can do is stand with them here in Canada and do what we can through policy, but also by calling out war behavior and war actions and aggressor actions. And so I wasn't planning to go to Russia anytime soon, and I'm glad to be on that list and standing up for the people of Ukraine.
Now, do you know why you were one of the ones that made the list? Because I understand that there's some opposition MPs as well on the list, and
yes,
and I mean, is it because you're a parliamentary secretary, or is it because of things that you may have said about Russia?
It could be a combination thereof. I asked the same questions, Bobby, right away, because the press the press items that I seen about the individuals that are banned had the number around 313. So there are 338 MPs, and I know of that 313, it was certainly members of the government, opposition, senior civil servants and senators. So my guess is they had, the Russians had a good indication of who were in the chamber, who were on Zoom taking part in it in terms of parliamentarians. It's just an assumption. And also, posts that we've made. I've made several posts standing in support of Ukraine. One of the posts that I made was my conversation with Father Roman, which received a lot of attention online. So it could be a combination thereof of why certain people were singled out, both in government and opposition. But I assume it's a bit of both, or of the three. There's a bit of element one, element two, and element three playing a role in it. But it tells you, though, you know, it tells you how interconnected we are. I mean, yes, the war is happening in Ukraine, which is far away, but it's not far away from people that have relatives here in Cape Breton that can't reach out to their loved ones. And it's also opposition, you know, that the Kremlin is watching very carefully who's opposing this war, both in Ukraine and in Canada, and also in Russia. I mean, there are thousands of people that are in Russia right now that are opposing this war publicly. Man, you want to talk about leadership? Look at the people of Ukraine. Look at the president. Look at the average everyday Ukrainian. Look at the Russians in Moscow that are knowingly doing this, knowing that they're going to go to jail or worse.
Yeah, wow. The woman that works at the TV station that came in with the placard during the live broadcast. I mean, a pretty gutsy move for sure.
Amazing move. You know, it's easy to make decisions when you know your impact is the impact on you is limited in terms of negative impact. But boy, oh boy, I got to tell you, when you know that what the words that come out of your mouth or the actions that you take will most likely result in a negative impact on you and your family, and you do it because you believe in principles and you actually believe in freedom, it's a pretty amazing thing to watch.
And I wanted to talk to you about Vladimir Zelensky, the president of Ukraine's address to the joint session of parliament. You were there for that. What was that like?
I have never heard the chamber as quiet as it was while he was speaking. Of course, the only time that it got loud was when we applauded him, and rightly so. You know, I want to paint a picture for everyone listening. Before President Zelensky spoke, you know, parliamentarians and people, guests were gathered talking in the chamber. And there was a collegiality, there was a kinship, there was something that you don't see every day in the chamber. It's usually, you know, a bit of verbal combat, you know, hand-to-hand combat in the sense of people, you know, bringing up opportunities and challenges and policy and people countering that with their own interpretations, and sometimes it'll get heated. You know, it was not the case the morning of President Zelensky speaking prior to it. So there was, I had a sense of this is a moment in time. We're watching history. We're watching leadership in action with President Zelensky. We are watching a person who is fighting for his country's life. We're fighting, we're watching democracy in action, and we're watching democracy being threatened by authoritarianism. And we've seen this over the last 20 years, not so much war, per se, in Europe, but a rise of authoritarian tyrants. And who threatened democracy. And to watch this person somewhere in Ukraine, somewhere in Kyiv, speaking to what he is going through, his country is going through, to provide vivid examples, which I thought was brilliant on his part, to be able to say, picture if you live in one of your cities of Montreal or Edmonton or Calgary or Vancouver or Toronto or Halifax, whatever the case may be, wherever you're living, imagine the school that you went to is no longer there. Imagine the playground that you know, and he just kind of personalized it, but also superimposed. Imagine if Canada was under threat. And I thought that was a great way to kind of paint the picture for the beginning of his speech. And that was pretty much something he utilized throughout his speech, where he talked about what is happening to his country and to his people and to his infrastructure and whatnot. But also, you had a sense in his speech, as you everyone has a sense watching the news, is that you have mothers and daughters, you have scientists who are fighting on the front lines. It doesn't matter what occupation, what level of income, Ukrainians are standing up and just united to be victorious here.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sunday at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-284-NEWS. That's 902-284-6397. Or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcasts, available now online at coastalradio.ca.